Save big money right now at Menards. From smoke and carbon monoxide detectors to fire extinguishers and more, Kit of Home Safety products keep your family protected in case of emergencies. Smoke and carbon monoxide detectors are perfect for your living spaces, offering protection and peace of mind. Save big money on all Kit of products at Menards. Plus, check out our weekly flyer on Menards.com for all the great deals happening now. Save big money at
Menards. That's a gay ass podcast.
What? That's a gay ass podcast.
A what?
A really, really, really gay podcast that we call That's a Gay Ass Podcast.
That's a gay ass name for a gay ass podcast.
Welcome back to That's a Gay Ass Podcast, the podcast that asks, whose fault is it that you're gay? It is me, Eric Williams, and this week's guest needs no introduction. It is Ginger Minj, the winner of All-Stars Season 10 of RuPaul's Drag Race, which was, according to some people, a very controversial win. So I not only ask about that, but also about Trixie and Katya, who are recapping their season with Ginger, Season 7, and what it feels like to relive that chaotic time. So please enjoy Ginger Minj. The Glamour Toad herself is on That's a Gay Ass Podcast. Now, Ginger Minj, are the rumors true that you're currently in Provincetown, Massachusetts?
Oh, they are. I'm here for my fifth summer in a row doing my residency. I love it. I love it. It's the gayest assest town I've ever been in.
That is what I hear, and I'm devastated to report that I've never been. Are you mad at me?
I'm not mad. I'm sad for you.
I know. It's going to happen. I'm actually trying to work on bringing a show there myself. I also just want to like go there and just like ogle all the daddies on what's the main street? Is that commercial?
I want to like the main street. There's one street. It's Commercial Street. That is Provincetown.
Well, will you answer this rumor? Are the daddies the hottest you've ever seen in P-Town, or where are the daddies the hottest?
The daddies are definitely daddying here. I still think, as a theme park girly, that Disney offers the best Grace sweatpants, no underwear daddy moment. We
the
call
Grace
it bird
sweatpants
watching.
Of Disney. Yes. Oh my God. Listen, I remember that Instagram account, which is like the dads of Disney, where you're just watching these like beautiful gray sweatpanted men push a stroller. It's just divine.
Yeah. Oh my gosh. It makes my ovaries ache.
True.
And oh, listen, God, I want to be a mother for this reason.
And I see you with child. I really can see you living the beautiful prophecy of motherhood. I also love that you're getting us into the fact that you are a theme park girly, but you're also a huge theater queen. And there's a quote of yours in an interview where you say you stumbled into drag by doing theater. And as a fellow theater queen, I would love to know, Ginger Minj, were there any theater roles you did in high school that were either a complete slay or a very inappropriate casting moment for you?
Oh, my gosh. Well, first of all, I didn't do any high school plays because I was homeschooled through high school. And I did that because I was working full time doing like mini national tours and dinner theater productions over in Orlando.
What? So you kind of like it's giving child actor. Actress.
I was. So I actually like grew up doing a lot of plays with Mandy Moore. The two of us were like the stars of our little theater troupe. And then of course she went on to become Mandy Moore. I was like, well, here I am. I guess I'm just the Orlando star now.
Wait a minute. The fact that Ginger Minj and Mandy Moore have an origin story together, it's giving like Laura Bell Bundy being understudied by Britney Spears Broadway. Wait, what was Mandy Moore like as a child actress? Were you guys friends, sworn enemies? What was it?
No, I mean, I wouldn't say we were friends, but we were friendly. I mean, we were very young at the time. So it was, of course, like, you know, the boys didn't like the girls and the girls didn't like the boys, but I was the boy that wanted to be with the girls all the time. So I got let into that group a little bit. She was very sweet and so talented. I remember when she played Annie, and we had done this production where the orphans were mixed gender. So, I mean, there were boy orphans, girl orphans, and she was Annie, and she was incredible. And I remember hating her so much because I was like, I just want to be the curly redheaded belter. I want to do that.
Well, do you think Ginger Minj would ever put on a new production of Annie where you finally get to star as the titular role?
At this point, I'd have to call it Granny. I'm a little bit too old.
I would buy a ticket. When Mandy Moore, and every single person listening to this who did high school theater or like felt any sense of competition growing up, witnessed somebody have a moment in the sun that was devastating for them. When Mandy Moore came out with Candy, or when Mandy Moore did A Walk to Remember, or when Mandy Moore did This Is Us, did any part of you die inside, or were you able to just be happy?
No, I've always been able to just be happy for other people, because I've always felt like two things can be true at once. You could be sad for yourself and happy for someone else.
Sure.
I mean, and honestly, I've gotten that question a lot. Having lost Drag Race 3 times, that's always the favorite question of an interviewer. Are you sad that you didn't win, or are you happy for your sister? I mean, actually, yes, to both. But the one that was like, God, I wish that was me, was when she got to play Rapunzel in Tangled, because I love Disney. I love musicals. I wanted to be a Disney princess so bad. That's actually a lie. I wanted to be Ursula. More than anything.
Oh my God. Did you? They should have. I hope they auditioned you for the live action film.
They did. I wrote about it in my book. It was a very long process. I thought that I was actually going to get it. And at the very last minute, it was kind of this thing that they were like, well, if we went with you, we wouldn't be able to show this film in this country, this country, this country, or this country, blah, 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 blah. But they. Disney, they didn't have to, but they made it up to me. Like, I was in Hocus Pocus 2, which was a dream come true, because I love Hocus Pocus so much. And then I got to voice the first and only drag queen animatronic for I'm friends with. That's what we have to say. The first drag queen animatronic in a Disney park for the Zootopia ride in Shanghai.
Holy shit. So, you know what? You actually are an international Disney girl. Little Mermaid or otherwise.
Well, this is what proves. I'm going to tell everybody out there right now, if you sit your little gay ass down, get out of your own way and stop blocking your blessings, as my grandmother always said, eventually what is for you will come to you. And if you want to be this or that or whatever, there's not just one way to do it. Like, if you want to be a drag race winner, well, it's not always going to happen in the way that you think that it might or that it's happened for other people. So you just create your own path and eventually you'll achieve it.
Well, listen, Ginger Minj, if anybody can prove that some things happen the way that you did not plan them to, when you finally did win this recent season, which, by the way, congratulations. We are going to get into the reaction, but I want to say a huge mazel tov and a little tease. I will be asking you a bit about that. But can you tell me, just to bring to life your grandmother, what did you call your grandmother? What was her name?
She was Granny. Her name was Shirley Temple.
Shirley Temple, of course.
Not that one.
Was her name actually Shirley Temple?
It was Shirley Temple, and she looked like Snow White when she was younger, like the really pale skin with the bright red cheeks, the bright red lips, and the little curly black hair that she always had like tied up. I mean, she was a beauty, and I honestly feel like nobody in my family ever had much of theatrical inkling. Nobody could sing or dance or act or any of that, but I feel like she probably did have the talent, but she just never shared it with the world.
And she gave you that lesson to not, you know, dim your light. And in a way, she's probably performing through you, if we can be woo-woo.
Yeah, let's be woo-woo. My grandmother was very that. She was so progressive to a fault in a time where that was really looked down upon, especially by, you know, lower middle class white women.
And was this in Florida, or where was Granny?
It was in Florida. It was in North Florida. And in Florida, we always say, like, the further north you go, the further south you actually are.
Is that real?
That's true. That's what we say. I mean, she was maybe an hour and a half from the Florida-Georgia line.
So I see. So her being that progressive really was, like, a risk, a outlier for that time. And the fact that you, as this little gay boy, got to have Shirley Temple as your granny is such a gorgeous gift. But since we are getting into origin stories already, Ginger Midge, I do want to ask you the famous podcast question, which is, whose fault is it that you're gay? Who do we blame, babe?
It's probably the hormones in the chicken, or I don't know. Purdue. Actually, I blame my mother and my father. simply because when I was a baby, my mom had to go back to work. We didn't have money for like a babysitting service or a daycare. So my mom had seen, or my dad saw this little blurb in the local newspaper that said the local community theater was looking for a baby for their production of Fiddler on the Roof. And not only was it like free babysitting, it was also like a $25 a day stipend or something. So my mom was like, oh, well, they're reputable. So I can drop the baby off there. He'll be safe. He'll be cared for. And I'm going to make money on top of it. So my mom accidentally became a stage mom by volunteering me to the as a baby to the theater. And then like, in a community theater, you know, once you check a box, they always come back to that box for a refill. So I grew up on the stage. I
literally grew up in raised that, by the theater.
Raised by the theater.
Can you guess how old you were when you had your first role as the baby in Fiddler on the Roof? How many months would you say?
I was six months old.
Oh my God. Wait, you know what's incredible about this too? Is that you're on a gay Jewesses podcast, and the fact that it was Fiddler on the Roof is, you know, may the Lord protect and preserve the 6 month old ginger man. wow. Do you, I mean, I'm assuming, what was your first memory then? If you went from like Fiddler on the Roof at 6 months, you probably, you know, could not even form a single thought. But what was the first show that you then remember doing in community theater?
The first one that I have vivid memories of was when I played the mayor of the Munchkins in Wizard of Oz, because I was so obsessed with Wizard of Oz. My grandmother was born in 1939, and she always said three miracles happened that year. She was born, Tina Turner was born, and The Wizard of Oz came out in the movie theaters. And so I grew up watching Wizard of Oz, reading all the books with her. It was a very special thing for the two of us. It still is. Even if she's passed on, I still like, she's still part of that core memory for me. And I remember when they said, we're going to do The Wizard of Oz. And I went, I have to play the mayor. Mandy Moore be damned. I am going to
be damned.
The redheaded belter this time. And I was. And I remember like just my grandmother sitting there every single night because she would drive me back and forth, just singing along in the audience as mayor of the Munchkins. It was the sweetest thing. And it was such a good memory for the two of us.
And you really were. I mean, if you had been born into a straight body, you still would have been the gayest straight person ever, because the fact that you're putting a Fiddler on the Roof, Wizard of Oz, you're growing up alongside Mandy Moore, like you're Shirley Temple grandmother. It's all so gay coded. And
who is obsessed with not only Wizard of Oz, but Tina Turner.
Exactly. And so like she not only gave you like the faggy tendencies, but also taste. And I also want to give you a bit of a brag for myself, which is that so we're recording this on a Monday. So by the time this episode's comes out, I will have seen The Wizard of Oz at the Sphere in Las Vegas. Damn. I'm going on Friday.
I am so jealous. I am so jealous. I want to see it. And there is drama about that.
Girl, there is drama. So the reason why I'm going is because my husband is very obsessed with Wizard of Oz. I'm sitting next to, no joke, two ruby slipper, like expensive replicas that are in our bedroom in a glass case.
I've got them. I have those as well. Sure. I understand.
Have you ever made love to a person and then they had to ask why there are glittery slippers feet away from where they're being penetrated?
No. But I have been asked if they could wear them.
Oh,
and
well.
My response, no, those are not for wearing. Those are for looking.
Those are for display, honey. Yeah, no, ours are fully for display. Matt booked our trip with a friend of ours to Vegas to go see it. We're seeing like the second showing that they're showing. And I said to him the other day, I was like, are you still excited to go despite all of the controversy? Because there are people that are angry online about the AI of it all, that they've shortened it by 30 minutes. But he's like, no, he's just excited because it's like a 4D experience. They're going to fucking blow we're going to be in the tornado, bitch.
Yes. And the thing about it is, if you had shown the original movie in its original form at the Sphere, it's going to be so blown out, you're not going to be able to see anything. There's no definition. You have to build the world. And I could understand, maybe, if they were saying, like Star Wars, this is the new version of the movie, and this is the only one we're going to acknowledge. It's not. It lives in the Sphere for a limited amount of time, and it's the only place it's ever going to be.
Exactly. And I'm excited to experience it not only in the Sphere, but also with a mushroom chocolate at 11 a.m. That's going to be...
I'm so proud of you.
Thank you. I can't wait to feel like I'm one of the flying monkeys. Apparently, there's going to be drones for the flying monkeys. Apparently, it's just like... I cannot wait to feel like I'm in another world, partly because I'm under the influence of psilocybin.
Yeah, well, I mean, it's Oz. I feel like you have to be a little bit.
Thank you. It's the elixir. I don't fucking know. I'm trying to
have another drink.
There we go. My dog, beauty. You are, yes, a Wizard of Oz queen, but thank you for referencing the hocus pocus of it all, because this tour that is going to be launching on September 4th is called Hocus Pocus Live. And I want to get into...
H-O-K-U-S for legal reasons.
Yes, for the copyright girlies in the crowd. What I love about this tour is that you are really honoring your passion for... the Wicked Witch of it all, obviously in the reference of the movie Hocus Pocus. You being a part of the second Hocus Pocus with Bette Midler, she has given you her blessing. I mean, she loves your work. So before I get into the actual Hocus Pocus of it all, in Bette Midler's honor, I want to ask, how do you feel about bathhouses?
I've never been to a bathhouse before. I never have. I don't know. I have a lot of social anxiety unless I'm in drag.
Oh, that's interesting.
I spent a lot of years being an undiagnosed autistic person. And now that I've been diagnosed, I'm learning what that's all about and how I can overcome that and actually spend more time in public places as me. But I don't know. There was always something so overwhelming about the thought of going to the bathhouse.
Well, if I may ask...
Now I feel like I'm having my hot girl summer. So maybe I'll try it. Who knows?
Listen, I think it's never too late to have your first bathhouse experience. And I want to ask about the autism of it all, if you don't mind. Could you tell me what... how does it manifest? If you're talking about social anxiety, how does the way that you are... influence your thoughts in drag versus out? What are your fears that you are told by your own thoughts out of drag? That you're like, is it that you're not enough in public, that you don't know what to say? Like, what goes through your mind that gives you that fear out of drag in social settings?
I have a hard time collecting my thoughts, and I don't like to be misconstrued in what I say. So I like to be able to be on stage or in a situation where I've curated the character to the point where it's almost scripted, even if it's not, where it's like, you know, in the world of Ginger Minj, we hit these points, we talk about these things, we tell these kinds of jokes. Everything has maybe not been rehearsed, but okay, yes, it's been rehearsed. And I got dinged for that a lot on All-Star 6 in particular, where I thought I was really sharing some really deep moments about myself. But because I had replayed that scenario so many times in my head, it came across as a little insincere or a little too well rehearsed. And once I actually got diagnosed as autistic, I started learning what that was, why it was, and how I could remove that and just kind of be a little bit more in the moment. So even now, when I feel like I ramble a little bit too much or I can't fully piece my thoughts together immediately, I feel happier with the content because I feel like it's coming from a more sincere place, even if it's a little less easy to understand sometimes.
Well, it sounds like you before... enjoyed feeling the sense of control, because if you let loose that control, then you didn't trust what would come out of your mouth. But now that you're allowing yourself to sort of stream of consciousness, be more organic, you actually are realizing that as woo-woo as it is, like, you are enough without the rehearsal.
Yeah, well, and my granny always said, like, she's like, you never know, you can never truly see yourself until you see yourself through somebody else's eyes. I mean, she talked in quotes like Dolly Parton, shit that they stitch on pillows at the Cracker Barrel, you know? So when she said that, I never knew what it meant until I was on season 7. And it was the first time that I had seen myself reflected back at me through somebody else's perspective. And there, it was hurtful. It was really hurtful, but not in the sense that, like, there were people who didn't like me or whatever, whatever. It was hurtful in the sense that I felt like nobody understood me. Felt like what I was saying was being taken completely out of context, because I knew how I meant it in my head, but I understood how it came across by watching it. And that's what made me start going, okay, well, I can't have this happen again. So let me think about all of this and figure out what the answer is before anybody even asks the question.
Listen, it makes a lot of sense. I think when you grow up also as a gay person trying to feel safe, you try to guess what everybody's going to say. And so I think that we try to, again, have a control over how we're being perceived or what we're saying. And while this might sound like a right turn, I promise it connects, but I took a few weeks off of smoking weed because I realized I was, like, using it to cover my own feelings and thoughts, and it was just, like, really comfortable, and I fucking love it. And then the 3 weeks I stopped smoking weed, all of these wretched feelings about myself came up, and I realized that I was just, like, hiding from my own anxieties about myself. And once I, like, really listened to them, I could hear that they're not true, but they're so strong from, like, what I was told as a kid. And so I think that,
oh my god, that makes so much sense, because I used to drink a lot, like, way too much. I'm definitely an alcoholic, and I've learned that in the time since. But that was also part of the job, right? Where you get drunk, you sell the liquor at the bar, and the more money they make on that, the more money you make, and the better you're going to be, the more bookings you're going to get, blah, 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 blah. So drinking became a part of my everyday work life. It became a part of who I was, and I loved the way that it dulled all of my thoughts and opinions on myself, and I felt like I could just be free to be an asshole and funny and sassy and whatever. And then when I stopped drinking, because I knew I had to, it had come to the point where it was like, you're either going to give this up or you're going to die.
Yeah.
Or ruin everything. And it was the same thing. I remember those first couple of shows having to go out there sober and not thinking I could do it and not getting through it. And now I can't imagine how I ever got through doing a show so drunk before. We're so out of my mind. Because I'm like, it takes so much concentration to get through these things and to, you know, get everything working together in tandem. But yeah, it was hard. And you start sitting there with all of your own thoughts and opinions about yourself.
What
and
were
you have
those?
To figure out.
What my like, I think it's sometimes fun to categorize what our fucked up thoughts are as a way of, like, pointing out that they are not our own thoughts, but the other people's thoughts. My thoughts were, you are too much, you're cringy, or, I mean, of course, my thoughts still can be this way. So the thoughts that come in, you're too much, cringy, full of yourself, like, unsuccessful, no value. What would you say when you first stopped drinking were the loudest mean thoughts that you were hearing?
Mine were definitely, you're not enough.
Yeah.
You'll never be enough.
Yeah.
And you have no value.
Yeah. Yeah.
I felt like an imposter.
Yeah.
For sure. And because I also, like, stumbled into drag through theater, the lip syncing never was a part. Like, in my head, I was like, I feel like such a sham right now, just sitting here and moving my mouth around to other people's songs. I'm not a dancer. It took me a long time to realize that, oh, a lip sync is just acting.
Yeah.
So
all
I have to do, and I think that that's why a lot of people don't understand why I've won as many lip syncs as I have, but it's because I know how to tell a story.
Yeah.
And to the sense where I don't have to do splits and kicks and flips. As much as I like watching those, they're not something that I'm physically capable of doing. So in my wheelhouse, I know that I'm a great actor, so I can act these songs. And once I found that out, I felt like a little bit less of a fraud in the mainstream drag world. I mean, I'm talking before Drag Race even was a thing.
Yeah.
But I would also, like, I was afraid to show up and just sing live, even though that's what I had always done. And then once I started taking the risk and like, oh, I'm doing three numbers tonight, so maybe my last one will be a live song. Most people will be gone by then anyway. They started really showing up for that. And to the point where it morphed into a Broadway brunch on Sunday. And then Broadway brunch turned into Show Tune Sundays, where we ended up doing it all day long into a piano bar at night. So it was another one of those don't block the blessing moments, you know, where it's like,
absolutely,
get out of your own way, bitch, and just trust yourself.
At KFC, everyday value meets big flavor. That means getting six crispy pieces of delicious dark meat drums and thighs, plus four biscuits, all for just $10 with our Dine and Dash deal. All that juicy, original recipe chicken for only $10 every day. Now that's finger-licking good. Hurry into KFC and taste the deal we're cooking up. Limited time only. Prices and participation may vary. While supplies last, tax, tip, and fees extra. Not available on third-party ordering platforms.
Well, I think that's
been hard.
It sounds like you're doing the work, though, because I think that it's one thing to do that for yourself. It's another thing to then agree to go back on Drag Race, which you know has a very, we'll say, opinionated fandom. And then to go from that to doing this residency in P-Town, the Hocus Pocus Tour. I mean, for anybody who doesn't know, it's doing 22 U.S. cities. It's doing a New York's Town Hall, Lincoln Theater in D.C.
We're actually adding 10 more cities because it's been doing so well before we even opened.
Ginger.
Yeah, I'm so excited about it.
I'm so fucking happy for you because people don't realize the amount of work just, I think, logistically that goes into producing your own stuff like this, but then also emotionally to put yourself out there. And for people who have yet to buy tickets, you've got Jujubee with you, Safira Kristal, Dragula Champ, Landon Cider. I mean, it's, and clearly you're going to be singing your tits off on this tour.
Yes.
Actually, let me do this question. As we're picturing you with all, I mean, Jujubee has been on how many seasons of Drag Race? Like, a lot. I mean,
she did four seasons of Drag Race plus one season of Queen of the Universe. So she's technically competed more than I have.
Yeah. So, and she's, I mean, and Safira Kristal, I know, is like, just made such a huge impact just from her one season. Mm-hmm. But I just want to know, you get out of drag after a show. What American chain restaurant are you all kikiing out after?
Do you know, I love a Perkins. I love a Perkins so much because they have muffins and their muffins are huge. Their muffins look like me when I take off my corset. Just a little beautiful little muffin top. I don't know. If I had my druthers, it would be a Perkins. But I feel like there's not many of those left now. And I feel like the only place that's ever kind of open when we're done with drag is a Denny's or a Waffle House. And unless you live about 5 minutes away from a Waffle House, you're not going to make it from point A to point B. So by default, I will say Denny's.
I do love a Denny's. There's something about a diner that, I mean, talk about smoking weed. I like, if I have an edible or smoke some weed and then I'm sitting in front of a chocolate milkshake at a diner, you've never seen a happier me.
Well, like, where else can you get stuffed French toast, a T-bone steak, lasagna, or a chicken skillet?
Like, literally.
The menu is so all over the place, but I kind of love that because that's how I approach drag. It's like, I like a little bit of this, I like a little bit of that, and throw it all together and see what's on the menu.
And what the actual product is a winning goddamn queen. So let's get into the drag race of it all. There has been obviously a lot of controversy with your win. In fact, someone on Reddit said, "I truly feel that Ginger Minj is one of the greatest talents and simultaneously one of the most discredited queens by the fandom at large." Why do you think that is?
I truly believe that before Okay, first of all, before we even get into me and about this, I think that with everything going on politically right now, this is something safe to rage about because there aren't really any stakes to it. Nothing's going to change the fact that I won, ever. At the end of the day, it's RuPaul's Drag Race, and RuPaul decided that I won and she crowned me. So that makes me as legitimate a winner as anybody else. So there's no way to really discredit that, but I also feel like it's just something that, you know, you can be, get your gay ass all riled up about, because there are no stakes or consequences.
I think that's really a good point. You know, there's so many keyboard warriors that I think feel entitled to saying heinous shit on the internet. And I think that when it comes to Drag Race, that might be part of the reason why they're like, it's quote unquote only drag, which is why maybe they think that they're allowed to say whatever they want. Obviously, yeah, you are a real person with real feelings having to read these things. But I think that is a smart explanation for why people can get so opinionated and so personal. Yeah. With it.
Well, and I also feel it's like they feel like if they are getting up in arms about something politically that's going on, that they're just screaming into a void.
Right.
And their voice isn't heard. But when it's a smaller demographic of people who are already like-minded, maybe not sharing the same opinions, but sharing the same love for this one very niche thing, I think they feel like the more of a stink they raise, the more attention they might get from it. And I get it. I totally get it. And hey, they're passionate. And those thousands and thousands of views and comments and engagement has driven everything through the roof for me over the last month and a half. So I've been making money off of them saying terrible shit to me. So it's, I was prepared for it. I, having been on the losing side of it three times before, I knew that no matter who won or who lost, people were going to have opinions and they were going to be up in arms over it. They always are, particularly over All Stars. And if they want to say, oh no, this is different. No, this is the way you feel this time. But I remember last year when Angeria won, there was half of the people that were happy that she won, half of the people that were mad that Roxy didn't. The year before that, you know, we had Jimbo win and people were like, oh, it was rigged for Jimbo from the beginning. No, it wasn't. She deserved to win. But then you have Jinx. Jinx, who is the queen of all queens and has this incredible career and is one of the most talented people I've ever met in my life. You still had people say, oh, she didn't deserve it. So once I had sat through those, I went, it doesn't matter. I could literally walk on water and cure diseases as my talent show. And they'd go, I still don't think she should have won. So I knew it. I knew it. And I was fine. I was prepared for it. Especially when the promo dropped. And this is when I knew that people had already created the narrative of what they wanted. And they were like, oh, she's clearly going to win. And it's clearly going to be rigged for her. This is before the first moment had ever aired of me on All Stars 10. Even knowing in their minds that in the past, RuPaul has never had an issue putting me in the bottom, making me lip sync for my life, or sending me home. Ever. There were many times that these same people who now are saying I was favored or it was rigged for me have in the past, and I know because I've looked at y'all's comments histories, have said, oh my God, what does Ginger have to do? Murder somebody to get attention on this show? Like, she's being overlooked so many times. So it felt like they had already decided, okay, this is what's going to happen. They created the narrative and then they found things to kind of back that up throughout the season. Even though for me in person, it was the opposite. It was completely the opposite. In person, it felt like I was fighting every single moment to get any kind of recognition. It felt like every challenge that we did, I had already done and done well at in the past. So it felt like I had to be bigger and better than I had ever, ever, ever been just for them to acknowledge me.
Well, I hope that makes you feel so then hard-earned when you did get that win, because I think that the work that you have done, and when we go back to the whole talk about sobriety and the horrible thoughts that we tell ourselves, if you had not done that work, you probably would have read a lot of these comments, believed them, and said, they are right, I have no value, I blah, 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 blah. But because you've done the work, and you also did the emotional research to know that people are going to discredit you no matter what, you can say, they are saying what they are saying, my truth is my truth, and I'm not less of a person because of the hate that I'm getting. In fact, there's on the opposite side of it, there's so much love. I mean, Trixie and Katya are actually rewatching season 7, and speaking of sort of your history on the show, with Trixie and Katya rewatching season 7, they say they want to do a season 7 redo. Would you be down for that?
Oh my God, I don't know. I would love a reunion, to be honest. I love those girls. I was just talking to somebody about this earlier. The Logo days were such a lawless land. It was amazing. I mean, the budget was so small, nothing was union at that point. So, you know, you're shooting anywhere from 14 to 18 hours a day, sometimes 6 days a week. And there's very few PAs, very few producers, very few cameramen, anything. It was so shoestring budget, and they were doing their best to make it work. But you literally have like 14 drag queens who are doing this thing, this amazing thing for the first time in their life. So we would just wander off and start like stealing pieces of the workroom or stealing things from Untucked or like stealing light bulbs off of the main stage when people weren't looking. It was so much fun. It felt like summer camp.
Yeah.
And now, of course, it's gotten so much bigger and everything is, well, not everything, but a lot more things, are union now. So there's a lot more babysitters, there's a lot more rules, and there's always a camera somewhere. So like, even when you're sneaking out to smoke, you still got cameras all around you. So you can't have as much fun as we had on season 7.
So you want a reunion to really go and live through the old summer camp days of season 7.
I would love that. And the thing about it is season 7 was so different from any of the other seasons when it aired. And people did not like it when it aired because everything was so new. We had Ross and Carson for the first time. We didn't have Santino. A lot of the different challenge formats were introduced that season. The new Untucked was introduced that season. So everybody was like, whoa, 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 whoa. All these things that I have fallen in love with for the last 6 years is now totally different, and I hate it. Now you look back and you go, oh, season 7 was the turning point. That was the jumping off point for all of the things that we now hold near and dear about this show. They all stem from season 7. So it's aged like a fine wine. And I think it would be really interesting to have all of us sit down and discuss what that experience was actually like, because just watching the little snippets that you get during the season, it makes it look like we were at each other's throats a lot more than we were.
Yeah.
I remember sitting around in Untucked halfway through, and I got Mrs. Kasha Davis. She goes, this is going to be the most boring Untucked ever. This whole season of Untucked is going to be so boring because all of us are just getting along and we're just laughing and drinking and having a good time. And then I don't remember who it was, but somebody said, oh no, girl, they're going to edit this to make it look like we're actually not having a good time. And we're all like, no, they could never. I mean, this is awesome. And then we watch it and we're like, oh,
they did.
But like those moments happened, but they were so few and far between that wasn't really the experience. You know what I mean? Like cherry-picking bad moments.
Oh, of course. And I think that's probably partly why reality TV has become such a literal art form where the editing deserves awards, because it is all, just like you can, during a lip sync, tell a story as an actress, the editors of reality television are not only amping up the drama, but they're sometimes creating new drama just based on a snippet on Premiere Pro. Would you say that they, the editors did any of the, were there any like dramatic moments that were more tongue-in-cheek or from like sassy Library Is Open vibes, but they edited it to make it seem like really real anger? Or would you say that they just sort of capitalized on the actual tension that you did have, which was minimal?
The only one that I really remember reading differently in person than on screen for season seven was, I think it was at, act two. I think it was episode two. And we're sitting there. Oh, it was episode one. We were sewing those awful naked look things, the cover ups. So we're sitting there and Miss Fame had made a comment to me, and I still get along with Miss Fame. I love her so much. She had made a comment about, well, Ginger, I know that like sewing's not really in your wheelhouse. Like, how do you feel about that? Like, just trying to check in and also make a moment. And I'm sitting at the sewing machine. I'm like, oh, it's good. But you know what? Next week, if it's an acting challenge, all you hoes better watch out. And we're laughing about it. Like, we're all laughing about it going, maybe it's your week this week. Maybe it's my week next week. I can't wait to see what everybody does. And I remember watching that second or that first episode and that moment played with the behind it. And it made that moment just kind of look like out of nowhere. I was coming for those girls. And I knew then. I was like, oh, okay.
That fucking rattlesnake sound effect, the weight that she carries.
Uh-huh.
It's partly the geniusness of that show. I mean, it's, again,
I love, there's a clip in, oh, it's the Conjoined Queens episode, That Untucked, when I'm talking outside during the smoke break to Sasha Bell, and they're shooting over my shoulder so you can't see my face. You can hear that they've clearly cut together three words to make one sentence. It, instead of saying, me too, bitch, it goes, me too, bitch. I thought it was hilarious because the fans clocked it and tagged me in it. And I was like,
me too, bitch.
Me too, bitch. So I'll still say that to my husband sometimes. He's like, me too, bitch.
Oh, I'm still in it too.
But I love it. It's TV. It's fun.
It's so fun. And I just think that the way that you have been able to come on the show so many times and then just survived. You are a survivor. I think like I know that there are people listening right now that are like, well, I still think that it was rigged, or I still think all these things. But I think at the end of the day, no one can fault you for continuing to put yourself out on a very public platform in a way that is both vulnerable, but also like show girly and theatrical. And you also have been really vulnerable too in public about your weight loss. I think it's been really interesting how you told People Magazine, you said, I'm still plus size. And even at my goal weight, I will still be considered plus size. I like being that representation for people. I also think that giving this part of your life attention is really meaningful, because there was an episode on this podcast where Ben LaCreme and I discussed how people can be treated differently based on their weight. And so I'm curious for you, not only is talking about it publicly bringing attention to you in a way that, again, feels vulnerable. And second question is, have you felt a difference the way people treat you in one body versus another?
Absolutely. To both of those. I feel like everything that I do is vulnerable because I'm an open book. And that comes from season seven, where the reception wasn't the warmest to me, but the people who saw me and like really saw me, they still ride hard for me a decade later. Trixie Mattel, she has always told me to my face, she's like, you may not ever have the biggest fan base, but bitch, you have the most loyal fan base I have ever seen. And yes, they're big and they keep growing in numbers. But when I won, I didn't have time to get like bogged down in the negativity, because I was getting thousands of messages immediately from people that are like, you know, it's always nice to see the queen you're rooting for win, but there's something so personal about yours, because I have been on the ups and the downs and through the trenches with you for a decade. And every time I feel like I have to count myself out, you show up again, and I feel like I can keep showing up. So I have made it my goal for those people who see me and need me and identify with me to be as open and honest as possible. And a lot of people see that as a weakness. A lot of people see that as being annoying. A lot of people see it as being attention seeking. But if you see it that way, then it's not for you. It's just not meant for you. It's meant for those who need to see that and need to hear it.
Yeah. Somebody on TikTok the other day commented how I, on this podcast, it can be good, but I talk too much and my abbreviations are like, so like I abbreviate a lot of words that should not be abbreviated. And for a second, I was like, I could believe that and change everything that I do, or I can say that maybe this just is not for you. And I think that you saying that right now is like really hitting me. It's like, you know, it's okay like to not be for everyone. Like, that's okay.
Yeah. Well, that's why in the Golden Girls, you know, every gays have their own.
Yep.
You're the Blanche, you're the Dorothy, you're the Sophia, you're the Rose. Everybody would think that I'm the Rose. And maybe I used to be, because I wanted to be liked by everybody. And I always try to lead with kindness, even if it doesn't work out. But as I've gotten older, I've definitely turned into the Blanche. And not just because I'm at the height of my sexual prowess and I'm a Southern lady, but mostly because she is a kind person who understands her worth. And she also isn't afraid to go for what she wants, realizing that if it's meant for her, it's meant for her. And if it's not, it's not. And she's not everybody's cup of tea. So those are the life lessons that I have gathered by playing Blanche for the last 7 years in Golden Gals Live. And it really, like, I saw the parallels to my mother. Because down to the haircut and the bamboo earrings, I'm like, you always looked like Blanche Devereaux to me. But now I realize she really, like, was my mother. I'm just playing my mother. All of these values that people laugh at, you know, they are very valuable.
It's always so fun to see drag queens realize how they're doing their mothers in drag, because I think every gay boy especially feels parts of their mother inside of them. Like, I know I am a Jewish mother in so many ways in my inside. And it's so cool to see you embrace yourself. And I am curious, with your fan base seeing so passionate, have they responded in any way with this new body that you're in? Has it felt like you have gotten just the same amount of support? Have there been any people feeling differently? How has that reaction been?
To be honest with you, I haven't seen any negativity from my core fan base based around that, because they all go to me and they're like, holy shit, like, if you can do this, I can do it too, because I've been so open about it. I'm not one of those girls that's like, oh no, just diet, exercise, and hard work. No, I'm like, it's a tool. It's a tool. And if you talk to your doctor, there is going to be a way for you to have a path to becoming a healthier version of yourself. And that's what I set out to do. It was never about losing the weight, because I was always happy as a plus size girl. But to be, like, fully candid with you, the whole reason I went back to All Stars 10, like, they had called me to do things in the past, like, since All Stars 6, and I was like, I can't, I'm not in that space, I don't want to do it, I don't want to take the time, blah, blah, blah. Not realizing I was getting heavier and heavier and sicker and sicker. I was 340 pounds at 5'3" tall. My cholesterol was through the roof. My blood pressure, I was on 2 different medications for that. Horrible sleep apnea. So I was pushing myself to work all the time, not sleeping on top of it ever. Pre-diabetic. And then I got COVID, which turned into pneumonia.
Ugh.
And ended up in the hospital, and I genuinely thought I was going to die, because, like, a couple days turned into a couple weeks, which turned into a month. And I really thought that was it. I thought that was the end. And whenever I got the call, they were checking up on me to see how I was doing, and then said, you know, well, do you think you could be better in, like, a month and a half? And I just busted out laughing. I'm on my deathbed and you're asking me if I could be better. And then they were like, no, we just wanted to make you laugh. But seriously, do you think you might be better in a month and a half? And I said, well, I don't know why. So they invited me back to do Tournament of All Stars. And I was like, you know what? It's a small time commitment. So I feel like it's something that I could like physically do. And it gave me like hope and smile and like gave me a reason to keep going. You know what I mean?
I mean, so, like, hope and a deadline can do a lot.
Yes. I felt so lost. And in that moment, I suddenly realized, oh, I'm thinking about like the positivity of this, of what could be, and the excitement of going back into the competition. So I'm not even focused on how sick I am and how sad I am and all of, and like how just depressed this has all made me. So the very next morning I called this doctor. His name is Nelson Leach from Blues and Blahs. He had hired me to do some Instagram videos for him like 2 years prior and had said, you know, if you ever need anything, reach out. So I reached out and I wrote this whole long diatribe about everything. He called me immediately and said, oh, I got you, girl. I got you. And we started with all the blood work and the talking and the therapy and all that shit. And with his help, I literally have lost 170 pounds. I'm off my blood pressure medication. Sugar, blood pressure, everything is under control. Sleep apnea is totally gone. And I'm happy. I'm happy. And drag race, like going back to All Stars was the kick in the ass that made me do that. And you can see it on the season. I start at my worst and I end at my best. And it was really special for me. It was life-saving for me. So that's why nothing anybody ever says about me choosing to go back a fourth time will ever resonate, because I had my reasons and my reasons saved my life.
And listen, bitch, you got not only your health, but you also got some gorgeous perspective, and that is priceless. And I could not be more happy for you. I mean, that's just, and again, so inspiring for you to continue to talk about it so openly. And I think it makes a lot of people, it's understandable why your fan base is so passionate, because
Well, and I call myself a glamour toad all these years, not simply because like it's funny and it's cute, but also I put it all out there, warts and all. So if you're going to love the glamorous parts of me, you've got to love the ugly parts too.
Warts and all. Well, Ginger, it has been such a pleasure to have you on Gay Ass Goddamn Podcast. And before we round this out, I am going to ask you the final podcast question, which is, if the world was ending, you could only save one character actress, who would you save?
Oh my goodness, who would I save? Probably Michelle Williams, because I think she is one of the best actresses of our time, and I don't think she gets enough credit for it. As Gwen Verdon.
Oh, I was just going to bring up her Fosse Verdon theater. She clearly is one of us. I mean, she knows.
One of us, 100%. And the thing about it is, you know, I was of the, how old are you?
I'm turning 36 next month.
36, okay, I'm 41 in 2 weeks. And Dawson's Creek, I remember when it premiered, it was like, oh my gosh, a soap opera for us teenagers. So I was so invested in it, and she was the one I hated. I hated Jen. I hated everything about her. And when she like grew up and started doing all of these big movie roles, I was like, oh, I'm just gonna hate these. No, I think she is the next Meryl Streep. I think she is such a brilliant, underrated actress.
By the way, hard agree. And I don't know if you've seen one of the saddest shows on television, but it's called Dying for Sex. And it is, you can stream it on Hulu. It's Michelle Williams is the star of it. It is truly one of the best things I've seen in a long time. Again, once you get through the whole thing, it is devastatingly sad. But she is one of our living legends. And she's, I just thought she's 40. She's actually turning 45. Wait, when's your birthday, Ginger?
9/11,
as Caitlyn Jenner said, 9/11. Well, her birthday is 9/9, so you and Michelle are 2 days apart, if I could do that math, from 9 to 11. A gorgeous answer. We are all three Virgo queens here. And yes. So I would like to wish you a happy early birthday. I would like to wish you
as well.
Thank you so much. A huge thank you for coming on this podcast. And of course, everybody listening or watching, should be seeing your Hocus Pocus live tour. Hocus Pocus with a K.
Hocuspocuslive.com.
But besides that, Ginger, will you tell the listeners where to follow you and anything else you would like for them to know?
Yeah, I'm on all social media platforms. Just find me there. Just search Ginger Minge. I'll be there. I'll be the one that looks like me. you can keep up with everything that's going on there and get my book. Honestly, if you've enjoyed any of the subjects that we've touched on, I'm going to tell you, you're going to love reading the book because there's a lot of really helpful stories in there and 50 delicious recipes.
Southern Fried Sass. I hard agree. It's an incredible memoir / cookbook / Ginger's deliciousness. So Ginger, I hope this is our first of many conversations, and I look forward to continuing to see you fucking slay.
Slay.
Thanks for joining me on That's a Gay Ass Podcast. If you enjoyed this episode, make sure you are subscribed and drop a comment on YouTube if you are watching us there. You can also watch this week's bonus episode with Josh Drake, who is a very hot bearded Broadway baby living in New York City, but recently said no to doing a Broadway show so he could live a happier life. You can hear all about that and his slut tales at Substack, which is linked in the description, along with all the other horny bonus episodes there with Derek Cage. And Jake Cohen is coming up next week on the podcast. And we did a bonus episode recording for him because he had some slut tales he needed to tell us about. So enjoy the bonus ep with Josh Drake. And I'll see you next week for another gay ass guest. Bye.
You've been listening to That's a Gay Ass Podcast, hosted by me, Eric Williams. If you want to see and hear more, make sure you're subscribed to us on Instagram, TikTok, YouTube, Spotify, Apple Music, or Patreon at Gay Ass Podcast. That's a Gay Ass Podcast is executive produced by Eric Williams and produced by Nathaniel McClure. We'll see you next week.